Colin from the Catholic Sisters for Dale. This poem, can you all hear me? I feel like... This poem started a couple of years ago. I had an experience where I came in contact with somebody who couldn't read and had a bad effect on me. I've never really, you know, come into contact with somebody who couldn't read, and it's a shocking thing, especially somebody who takes words so much for granted. And that's where this poem came from. And it's set in London. N4 2DE. Across the Seven Sisters Road, the sign on the 12 tin bar is weary gold, and still can't read. Found out when he ended up in Oxford Circus, has an F, the same as Finsbury Park. And on the phone I hear him say he can't see where I'm standing, because of all the people. I look. There are no crowds on the Seven Sisters Road. I see a red sign and there's a wall, he whispers. A wall, I say, and wince at my surprise. Can you spell Finsbury for me, he breathes. And he is hoping for another symbol, perhaps a D to help him see. So I slowly tell the letters. F, yes, F, like F off. I, yes, I. And N, yes, N, like the N in silence. Phil, are you there? F. I, he fumbles. Is there someone there to ask? Is there someone at that circus there to tell you where you are? A woman takes his phone. I ask her sympathetic voice to help him to get home, to show him where to change. So Phil goes down the steps again, gets on another train. He listens to young tourists and tries to spot an F among the blur of line on colour on the way to Finsbury Park, where I wait on the Blackstock Road. N4 2DE, across from a red pub with green paint too, and flowers still, in baskets, and seats to sit and talk and see the pictures of the people as they walk by. Still can't read words, assemble letters, so when literate men at death shout, when they thrust forms, still can't fight, but still can translate faces. Behind the words he can see expressions, disgust, impatient. Says he wants to support his family but still can't read, so that practice as simple as getting a train is fraught. And when he comes out of the station, I wait to see him see. His life is writing in his eyes, and in their brown is fear. Still can't read, so he digests colours. The blushing red sign, the grey wall. He absorbs patterns. The glyphs the trees make against the homes. The blast of shapes along the drought green road, the contour of nature in its path, the stains of life on walking. He sees the flowers, sees me and waves, carves out the mark of familiarity in the air. This fucking place, he says, this fucking place. This next poem is, I work as a visual artist as well, and I'm like anybody who writes this, presenting creative, it's hard to keep it going a lot of times. I find it really hard sometimes to give myself permission to be as creative as I, you know, to let myself express the way I want, the way I should be able to allow myself to express. God, that's really bad. So sometimes it's difficult to give myself permission to create. So that's kind of, this is kind of a weird poem, but that's kind of what it's about. But that whole idea of giving myself permission. On a beach in Dublin. I meet Candide among the warm dunes after striding for miles over a 10-yard stretch of sand. I watch a bean-soaked breeze and know myself from the smallest particle of flesh. This is the best of all possible worlds. I speak with Salvador Dali. My heart fills, and he and I watch his horses come across the sea from Wales, I think. The small waves that grip for their spindly legs, and the moon plays this game too, twirling at just the right moment. Sal agrees with me about the perfection of proportion. Then, when the stampede has passed, we are stirred to talk of relatives of Jesus, and the way they could walk on the black skins of waves as sure as any man. I watch Sal, he's tired, walk off towards the bridge. I closed my eyes and rode the other way. Wallace Stevens' peacock, stolen from some ancient Greek, marked behind me, their step in time with every pulsing neuron. I understand the chaotic dance. Without looking, I see them there. I stop, they stop, claws hesitating in the air. I feel the smell of color, smell the iridescence flashing in their ostentatious strut. Again, it is the moon that plays. Even beyond my soft eyes, I know the double dealing goddess is messing with the pattern, making offensive gestures in the face of fear. My blood fills with hope. This is the best of all possible worlds. Candide comes back, both man and woman, hands a drink to me that remembers the valiant taste of lime and flashing ice. I lift my veil, believe the city in my lungs, the dawn that walks too quickly. I ask Candide to stay a while. We sit, making cushions on the sand, hold hands, silent, but for thought. So what about this painting, about this poem? Let the sea express itself in words. The waves show themselves in color. Why the sea? It's yours, the underwater, the cracked life. He asks softly about Sal, the man whose dreams are never black, then tells me that he too has to go. I sit alone in the breaking shade of the beanstalk, in the shadow of the possible. I studied Latin. I was very fortunate actually to study Latin at school, and we did book 6 of the Aeneid. I can't even say probably the Aeneid versus Aeneid, where he goes to the underworld. That book, very good book. He goes to the underworld and he meets Dido, and she has been living like fallen in love with him, and given up everything for him, basically, her memory, her community, her family, her power. She gave up everything for him, and he left her because he was answering his call to fate. He was being a hero, and I always thought this was kind of, just an easy way out. Like, and he left her in hell or in the underworld, and she turned her back on him. I always thought, yeah, that's right. Like, but he got kind of frustrated or was, anyway, so this was my trite little observation. I kind of always imagined him, walking away kind of disgruntled that she had ignored him, and so he writes her a note. P.S. Dido, it really was very rude of you to ignore me in hell. What on earth were you thinking? You're a very trite. There we go. I just have a couple of poems here. I suppose no more than any, but I spent a lot of time listening to the radio and BBC World Service, and you get to hear a lot of voices and stories just a lot of different voices and stories, and it's kind of very interesting. But an awful lot, especially recently, of stories from women in war zones, women who are dealing with death and stuff on a daily basis. I don't know why that happens. Maybe there's the people who are speaking out or talking. Anyway, it's kind of just affected me a lot. So I wrote, and I don't know how this is going to work now, because Villanelle, who is just a repetition speaker, give it a go. It's called Crosses, Stars, and Moons, and I just started with a quote from Virginia Woolf. As a woman, I have no country. As a woman, I want no country. As a woman, my country is the world. Crosses, stars, moons. The spin of war can make no woman mute. This dry market should not be a place to die. For cross, for star, for moon. No absolute truth can protect the bright truth. It's bruised and torn, blind in all its eyes. The spin of war can make no woman mute. From a mess of limbs, she recognized the boot. The gesture in her hand, a lost secret, a last sign. She knows that crosses, stars, or moons aren't absolute. There's just a bloody threshold left to root, with shrieks from seeds and seedlings crammed to the sky. The still of war can make no woman mute. She sees children cry, and can articulate how flight intends imaginary wings, not to die by cross, by star, by moon, and absolutely can't ignore the market is no longer safe, or how tossed fruit makes a shadow of the sky. The spill of war can make no woman mute. That cross, that star, that moon, no absolute. And there's a second one here. Just a reaction to this. I think we, every day we're exposed to more and more graphic images of stuff that we really don't want to be seeing, but you know, I'm not sure if there's to say we're becoming newer to graphic images of war. But anyway, this is just a reaction to a particular photograph that I saw, simply called War Photo. All to be seen were the trousers at his ankles, when trousers like that should be the dropped pants of comedy, and his blood on the ground was ink without the ruby of laughter. The word beneath should reveal how a word like hate is spread between the raised hand and the bruise. I didn't read. I thought, could these people fashion a lampshade from his skin, peel it from that grey place on his thigh, a useful tool, that's what he's always been. I'd like to look there. I have I've written quite a few poems based on my childhood in the 70s in Ireland. And this is one of them. Sorry, Kim. I was brought up in Knock in St. Mayo, which involved a lot of math. So I was too close to you, actually, this is loose to the bells, it's not the Duke Mask, it's based in Knock. Bringing tea to the men working with Maloney Combine. The combine harvester stopped, and many knew what time it was. Such was the stillness, I heard the bells from Knock Shrine sneak right up to our front door. I was wearing just knickers because of the heat and no shoes. The crumbling lane powdered on my feet. Don't dawdle, she said. I passed the bald earth that falls into the bank where the stream was allowed to be. I watched the wall grow on the high side of the ditch, and over it I saw a hollow filled with weeds, nettles and things, the trees beyond the Maloney's land. The white handkerchiefs were like veils over their rosy foreheads. Stomachs wet and stuck underneath dirty shirts, and the way they called the fields by name. I listened to their voices add hunger to sandwiches, saw the small bottle of whiskey they passed around. They laughed about the colour of my hair and the experience of sun on skin, and how a combine harvester could choose a little girl. I'm sure, like, probably everyone in this room made the first communion, and it's really kind of, well, when I grew up and stuff, and after all that math role and stuff, everything my parents get away from it, but it's something I keep coming back to in writing about just my early years of college. My father was exposed to it, I mean, it's what everybody around me was doing and stuff. This actually poem is based on the idea of, you know, where we attach stories to objects ourselves. Yeah, we all have something that we don't want to lose, whether it's a pen or a piece of jewellery or something. So that's where this I got across from my first meeting, like I say. I've had some of those little golden ones that looks like it should be in a gravestone. Anyway, this is the cross. Remember its white furred box, charming and sensible, laid out in a chaste satin hook. The holy day of the short skirt, clad in faulty armour for the age of reason. The dress, an older cousin's awkward gift, washed in Omo till the white released its grey, made for a girl with longer legs, and the cross, the weapon. The dry air at that time of year intended flowers not to bloom so much. Men marked thirsty fields and shook their heads. Those skies are occupied with spheres, and artificial reverence eased the light of clouds. The cross, the dress, and the fact that Tara had more money, her bag was whiter, She knew prayers and had no fear of sin. She understood the Sabbath. The pew was harsh and boasted of smells no gold known, with a creak and a moan of wood that old ears heard, with limbs once torn and sore, and we, an ill-composed stave of white notes, we made no sound. Silent and hidden song to our gangly walk, to the knee toe knock wavy sound, clutching our new handbags in a weird pretense of growing up. And in the back row, mothers, hair freshly waved, we smelling of a sour meadow, knowing the sick way a well-worn 10-pound note feels in the hand, the cross leering on my chest, and beyond the chance, a frightened urge to laugh, feeling the darkness behind crammed with faces that could pull a slap out of a smile. Possibly this gold would protect me from the eyes of Kevin Riley when he saw me bundled into the back of the car, legs stinging where the hand came off. The gold cross was lost to the ground, pushed deep into the mud, those Celtic knots and holes making a fast mold that shouldn't be found by some young girl of a future nation who has no need of God or sins. And when I consider the cross before that clay darkness, I can suffer again the sticky peat of gold pressed between the pillow and my cheek. Was the necklace better in the toomy box, where even breath could take its virtue? It was such a delicate thing, with Renaissance paling, the upright graveyard cut. In 75, the guilt was the confusion of the cross, and I, bound to declare great grave sins, not the deliberate take and burial of the stunt limbed gold in a miry hole after the rain, then quietly bearing consequence, the scalp across the back of the leg, the sting behind the eyes. This year, I praise the feeling of that loss, not a confession, but reason tells me there's a bliss gone past. I steadily recall its short history on my skin, rubbed to feel the bare reality, to grasp a relic of some mythical gift from across the duration. Wounded by absence in a ceremony of years, I know the need to behold a family, not of shadowy ghosts, but flesh and blood, who can feel the warmth of gold. I'll just read two more. I seem to be just braided. This one, we spent an awful lot of time in kitchens, all of and this is just like for a room that we spend so much time about. I try to write about kind of invariably successful, and this is a bit cancer of why. The weather is most obvious in a kitchen. Once I thought there should be more than three exits from this kitchen. The heavy glass door rigid against the heaping outside. The panelled door sweeping deep into the lonely bowels. The white door running to the dead end of the back kitchen. Once I thought there should be more than three exits. The fourth door I would cut into the wall beside the window, where most of the sun comes in. A door without glass, so that when viciously shut, it would not shatter. And I'm not going to say it, but the coat and the alleyway. We climbed Kilpatrick on a sunny day with clouds. I was wearing nothing but the shroud of a t-shirt and the bravery of my bare legs beneath my shorts. At the summit, I did not pray beside the iron bed, but watched the billow patterns and clean bay. When the mist, the fog, that rain, made a power in the ascent, I scrambled down. In the games of Westport, I blagged a dusty coat from the curly-haired landlord, who hauled it from the dust. A navy frock that hadn't seen the light of day for years, and bore the folds of solitude like well-earned wealth. I hooked to four hose buttons from the right, careful with their angles, ragged threads. The once shiny lining clung to my clammy skin, sheathed me in a malingerer's fist. I wore it down Bridge Street, its mantle darkened against the adamant rain, a sail on my back and eyes singled out beneath the call. I had chips for my hunger, a flagon of cider, 26, and a promise of a joint in the pocket of my shorts, if I had skin, and I had skin. I was 2 days shy of 21. In the hollow alleyway, me and travellers met. We shared our drinks, turning to sweet mouthfuls of jealous lips, and they promised I'd never be fit for a lift when I hitched with more clothes on, they said. But they wouldn't let their daughters be seen with the likes of me.